WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio 88.1, KRFP Moscow, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Olympia, WGDR Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft time from the widows and orphans, and never a hard-working man I oppress.
Well, I say, it's Code Jim, this is Rich.
Hey, Rich, this is Bill up at Enron.
What's happening, Bill?
Not much, man. I'm giving you a call. We've got some issues for tomorrow.
Okay.
You ready for some issues? You're just about out of there, aren't you?
I got a couple more hours. I ain't going anywhere.
Good.
All right, shoot. I've got pen and paper.
All right, man. This is going to be a word-of-mouth kind of thing.
Okay.
Tonight, when you finish your normal QF, so for hour ending one,
right,
it'll actually be tomorrow.
Right.
We want you guys to get a little creative.
Okay.
And come up with a reason to go down.
Okay.
You anything you want to do over there? Anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah. There's some stuff that we could be doing tonight.
That's good.
You know, we need to come down and inspect this switch on the steam turbine. This one switch on this induction steam valve has been failing us, and we need to be down in order to pull the switch and adjust it. Yeah.
I like that.
And our electrician just happens to be on shift tonight, so that works out kind of good. Okay, so...
But we're not wanting to have it pre-scheduled.
Right.
It's supposed to be, kind of one of those things.
Okay, so we're just coming down for some maintenance, like a forced outage type thing.
Right.
And that's cool.
Hopefully.
Yeah, and whatever adjustment he makes today, tonight is probably not going to work, so we're probably going to have to check it tomorrow afternoon again.
I think that's a good plan, Rich.
All right.
I know I can count on you.
No problem. I'm sure I'll have a good time. All right, so I got you covered for tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Rich.
All right, I won't even put that in the book. Okay.
Right on, man.
Bye.
Talk to you later.
Well, there you have it. Caught red-handed. His actual, one of the actual calls of these criminals from Enron setting up for the Vegas utilities to go offline, artificially manufacturing some kind of repair to lock in California to rip off the taxpayers' billions. Now, you have people on fixed income in all of these states. These hoodlums don't care about it. So what is more important? Terrell Owens trying to get a higher contract that doesn't affect your pocket in the real world, or these clowns ripping off the states billions of dollars that directly comes out of your pocket. In other words, the way that the type of callousness that is perpetuated and ignored by the corporate media gives an indication of how the machinery works.
Take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest.
And that was Tracy James of Slave Revolt Radio, and this is Unwelcome Guests, and I'm Lynn Gary. May 1st is celebrated as Labor Day all over the world except for in the USA, where the holiday originated. In 1887, four Chicago anarchists were executed and a fifth cheated the hangman by killing himself in prison. Three more were to spend 6 years in prison until pardoned by Illinois Governor Altgeld, who said the trial that convicted them was characterized by hysteria, packed juries, and a biased judge. The state had, in the words of the prosecution, put anarchy on trial and hoped that their deaths would also be the death of the anarchist idea. The anarchists were trade union organizers, and thus May Day became an international workers' day to remember their sacrifice. They were framed on false charges of throwing a bomb at police who were violently breaking up a demonstration in Haymarket Square, which was part of a strike that started May 1, 1886, involving 400,000 Chicago workers who were demanding an 8-hour workday. Starting this week on the program and continuing every other week through the fall, we're pleased to present a course by radical economist Doug Dowd on capitalism and its role in shaping the present and future of the USA. To set the stage for the first lecture, we go first to Brooke Haggerty, author of Moving Onward, From Racial Division to Class Unity.
Capitalism is an inherently unstable economic system, and we can see that by looking through history that it's lurched from boom to bust and back again. In the past, this was mainly a matter of overproduction. That's as too many goods being produced for the market to absorb. People were laid off, production was cut back, inventories went down, and eventually people were called back to work and production got going again. Maybe some companies went bankrupt and a smaller number of companies now produce the same amount of goods, or other companies moved in and started taking up that part of the industry. But the main thing is that workers were always needed in the production process, who then, of course, would buy goods and keep the market going with the wages that they got from their jobs. Or another way things got going again was a market was created for goods, like the situation you had in World War II. For several years, the country had been in a terrible depression, but because of the war effort, the government needed jeeps and tanks and planes, etc., and people were put to work to produce those things. And we've all seen that old footage on the History Channel of the workers pouring into the munition plants and the auto factories and into the shipyards to build destroyers and aircraft carriers. The need was so great, the government even put women to work in factories, which of course was not unheard of, but it certainly was unheard of in such numbers. In fact, to allow these women to work for the war effort, the government even created daycare centers, special programs, etc. So it shows what the government can do if it needs to. Hundreds of thousands were put to work, and this, along with the government, of course, being a huge consumer, helped to pull the country out of the depression. Today, we still have this same boom and bust cycle. We're still experiencing that. But the context in which this is taking place is entirely different. Computers and robots and digital technology, all of these are forms of labor replacing technology. That is, they do the work that people used to do. This means that people are not needed in the same ways or in the same numbers that they were in the past. And that's not all. Because these technologies can produce things faster and cheaper, it lowers the value of all human labor. This means that not only do we see unemployment spreading throughout the society, but the value of the labor of those who are working is being steadily driven down as well. So this is also true for blue-collar sectors like manufacturing, but also for white-collar work like managers and workers with specific skills. For example, because of this technology, one white-collar worker can now do the work that would have taken three white-collar workers 10 years ago. And military spending's not going to get us out of it either. Now, this is going to help the defense industry, but it's not going to help to provide those much-needed jobs. The defense industry has also made use of labor-replacing technologies, just like every other industry. So they can easily expand their output without either calling back their old workers or hiring new ones. Now, of course, there's some hiring going on in the defense industry, but this is mainly in the higher skilled work, such as sophisticated software and systems engineering. This will benefit a handful of workers, to be sure, but if the rapid advancement of technology in the last 10 years has been any judge, many of these workers will also be made obsolete. And the impact of this technology goes way beyond unemployment. It undermines the capitalist system itself. Capitalism is based on the buying and selling of goods. People have to buy. To buy, they have to have money. To have money, they need to work. When money is the only means of acquiring goods, and work is the only legal means of acquiring money, how are hundreds of millions of people around the world going to buy that ever-growing mountain of goods that robots and automation are producing when they can't work or when the work they get doesn't pay them enough to get by? So we're no longer simply looking at cyclical unemployment and the temporary interruption of the buying and selling of goods. What we're looking at is long-term permanent unemployment and the destruction of the capitalist market. So the capitalists have a big problem. We all see and experience what's happening around us and can give descriptions of those problems. The deteriorating schools, the crumbling cities, the terrible pollution and ill health we're experiencing, the violence and despair that people feel. I mean, people just can't live, no matter how much they scramble to make ends meet. The recent census figures came out, and they show that poverty is increasing among all groups, white and minority, women and men, and in every region of the country, and in almost every occupational category. And people can't help the capitalists out anymore by spending more, because people are drowning in debt. A recent survey found that household debt is incredible, more than 100% of disposable personal income, and this is the highest level ever. And at the same time, the capitalists are laughing all the way to the bank. They're making billions. And when they get caught doing something illegal to help them make those billions, like they did with Enron or WorldCom, nothing happens to them. Except what happens to the workers is that they lose their jobs, their pensions, and everything they've worked for all their lives. In a capitalist society, the government exists to protect the interests of the capitalists first. That is to say, to protect their ability to make those maximum profits. This can be done in a direct way, like with specific legislation to help one industry or another. Or it might be legislation that cuts interest rates or pushes through tax cuts or eliminates barriers to investment or gets rid of laws that protects consumers and society. That is anything that hampers their ability to maximize their profit. And even concessions to the workers are done in such a way as to advance the capitalist interests. And I think two important examples where this is happening today is this new education bill that was passed, the No Child Left Behind legislation, and the Medicare reform. But both of these pieces of legislation are being sold as solutions to the problems that people have with education and healthcare. But in reality, all they are is a means to help further privatize these areas and to open them up as areas for making profits for the capitalists. And of course, it further undermines the government's responsibility for the well-being of society. And this whole idea of the shift away from government's responsibility for society, I think, gets back to what we were talking about before, which is that with this technology, fewer workers are needed for the production process and to produce the goods of society. And it's no longer in the capitalist interest to provide what they provided for in the past, which is education or social programs, or even the little meager guarantee of health and welfare of the workforce that they provided in the past. Even that is not necessary and actually detracts away from their ability to make their profits. And I think that even deeper than this, the thing that affecting us is that it's directly related to the way that human life has become without any value to the capitalist class. We no longer are valuable to them because we can't produce for them. And so we see this in everything that they're doing. Everything they're doing reflects this. And I think that the current round of budget cuts, there's no better example than that, I think. The politicians are making specific and calculated choices with these budget cuts. They aren't just random choices across the board. They aren't talking about taking away that corporate tax break or taxing the ones who have billions of dollars. No, they're cutting child care or health care for the elderly. Polls keep finding that Americans want more money to go into social programs. They want money to be spent on protecting the environment and to providing for those who need it. They want more money spent on public education and health care. Now, it's a fact that most Americans don't understand or realize how much poverty is really out there. The interesting example was the Catholic Campaign for Human Development did a survey and found that most Americans believe that there's between 1 and 5 million people living in poverty in the United States, when the actual number is nearly 33 million. So in part, this is why I think people see poverty or economic hard times as a matter of personal failure. Of course, the capitalists spend a lot of time and money on making us think that this is the case. It's almost an industry in itself. You know, this concept of, you know, pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, anyone can make it, the promise of America is the opportunity to remake yourself and get rich. And the meaning behind this, of course, is anyone who is poor or struggling is a bad person. The biggest task, I think, facing us is getting the American people to see that their interests are not the same as the capitalists, and they really do have economic rights, and that they have to think about and act upon a vision of society where the majority of people in this country are provided for. This is a big task, particularly given the history of this country. But the economic situation is at least putting the question on the table.
Brooke Haggerty interviewed by People's Tribune Radio. Professor Doug Dowd has spent half a century as a public intellectual and activist, and he is the author of numerous books on the political economy of capitalism and its effects on society in the United States and the world. His long and controversial academic career spans several universities, including Cornell and UC Berkeley. Now retired from academia, he has for many years given free courses on economics for the general public in San Francisco, where he lives. I'm so pleased that we are able to broadcast his 2005 course in its entirety over the coming months. The course will focus on the content of his latest soon-to-be-released book, The USA, Where We Are, Where We Are Headed. The book begins with this paragraph. The rapidly unfolding set of linked socioeconomic and military crises at home and abroad have ominous potentialities, much worsened by the reckless ways in which those now in charge in the U.S. exert the several dimensions of their power. Even more ominous is that also at home and abroad, they get away with it. Now, to Doug Dowd, giving his first lecture in his 2005 course series last month.
Most of you here know me, and I know you, and that's fine. Some of you don't. But for those of you who know me, you'll notice that I'm a little more pale than usual, a little more chubby, and a little more bald than usual. The last two things have to do with age and indiscretions, but the first has to do with, as those of you who know us, my wife and me, Anna, well, we live in Italy half of every year, which means we have to come back and forth either on a boat or a plane. And this year, the plane, we had to be at the airport at such a time that we had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And we got to the airport on time. And 27 hours later, we arrived at our house. And that's 27 consecutive hours later, you understand. It wasn't our fault. It was the fault of modern air industry, which, as I've said to other people, it costs more and more every year to go, and it's more and more uncomfortable. The only comfortable plane we had was the last one, which we weren't supposed to be on. We were supposed to go nonstop from Paris to San Francisco. We had to, because they screwed up, we had to take two separate planes and a different airline. The last one from New York to San Francisco was the oldest plane I've been in for a very, very long time, and the only comfortable one I've been in. It's really interesting. They really are making them more and more uncomfortable, and you pay more and more and more. Anyhow, that's why I look pale, because I really haven't had much sleep and so on. So I'm glad to see us all here together again. Some of you will be disgusted to learn, and some of you will not be surprised to learn that I've done another book since I saw you last. It hasn't been, I'm not going to send it to the publishers for another week or so, but that's what this class is going to be about this year. In other words, the book, I won't get through the whole book with you. The book is called Where We Are and Where We're Headed. And the preface to it and the epilogue to it are on the website for the class. And I would say that if you want to make things hang together a little bit better, you can look at the preface and the epilogue. The preface, is, in effect, is which I'll be speaking from tonight, in effect tells what the book is about and why I felt it had to be written. And the epilogue is what we better be doing about it. It's called We Must Disenthrall Ourselves. We must really start very, very hard. When I say we, I mean the people in this country who still have some kind of decency flowing in their veins. And I think that that's at least a third of the people, but not even 1% of the people does anything political about it at all. And we just have to, or we're through, we're really through. And that's what I'll be talking about a bit of that tonight. And the rest of the quote semester, that is to say our first and third Mondays for the next 6 months, will be in effect what's in that book. And I'm going to at some point very soon read to you the table of contents, and that's what I'll be talking about this time. And some of you are from down the peninsula, some of you are from Oakland, but particularly the people down the peninsula might be interested to know that on April 21st, which is a Thursday, I've been asked to give a talk at San Jose State University, and it's a part of a series that's called Provocative Speeches or something like that, Provocative something. Well, it's a nice thing to know about that is that I taught there for 20 years, and as some of you know, 11 consecutive semesters they tried to fire me, 11 consecutive semesters. And so now they're looking for somebody provocative. They knew exactly whom to call. So the title of my talk is American Dream or American Nightmare. Those of you who live down the peninsula, some of you people here, you come down from Palo Alto and so on, you might want to go to that. 21st, it's at 5:15 to 6:45 at the MLK Library or something like that. Anyhow, I'll mention it again next time we meet, which is the 18th, third Monday. Okay, so let me just give you the table of contents of that new book. It's called Where We Are and Where We're Headed. And when I I started to write this about a year ago, and when I got a first draft and I sent it out to three trusted good friends of mine and asked them what they thought. It was interesting that two of the three of them said the last chapter should be the first chapter. And the last chapter is where we're headed. So I'm going to start the book out with, I did start it out now, it's the first chapter. It's called The United States Becomes Its Own Worst Enemy. And then the rest of the book tries to say why, where we are, and and then the epilogue is what we'd better do about it. And so tonight what I'm going to do is, and I have a long preface so that people will know what's coming. Where we're headed, I'll just say this in a paragraph now, a Dowd paragraph, which will take about 15 minutes, of course. Where we're headed, in my judgment, is that the United States as a nation, if the tendencies that we're in right now continue, will within a very short period of time, that is to say 5, 10 years, 15 years, it depends upon what's happening in the world, about which I'm going to be talking a lot, will become as a nation what the South was after 1877 and was called the New South. Now I want to ask a question of you, and I want an answer, an honest answer from you with the hands, nothing brash, nothing shy, except for things that I might have written, that you might have read, or I have talked about the New South and the 1877 Compromise, except for that that I have written, how many of you in your education, whether high school, grade school, or university, have ever gotten any conception of what the New South was? Yeah, good for you, Jerry, and you. Well, you, of course, you've got a PhD, you bum. But there are a lot of PhDs who don't have any knowledge. That's what I thought, because most people in the United States don't know anything about the sordid side of the United States at all. One of my favorite social scientists was Joan Robinson, British woman, English woman. And she used to say, history is the story of the battles that our side won. She was writing from a British point of view. That's nothing compared to the United States. We really don't know, we're not really taught anything at all about the sordid side of U.S. history. If we were told about that, it would take a lot longer for us to get through our history lessons and our history reading. Anyhow, so I'm going to now give you, in effect, the substance of why I wrote the book. And it's what we'll be talking about, or I'll be talking about, I hope we will be talking about, for the next 6 months. Let me begin. First place, I don't think anybody can understand anything about society except historically, except to understand it within a historical framework. That doesn't mean that if you understand history, you understand what's going on in the present. It means you can't understand what's going on in the present unless you can understand how we got where we were. Any more than you can understand yourself or anyone can understand you unless they know something about your evolution from childhood to the present. It's the same kind of process of understanding. Well, obviously we're not going to go back to ancient Greece, but we're going to go back, I'm going to go back to where our present began. Our present began as the last century began, that is to say, as the 19th century ended. And what happened then, as some of you know, was that there was one hegemonic country, that is to say, a country that ruled the rest of the world with its power so great that it didn't have to use guns all the time. It had to use carrots and sticks, and that was Britain. Britain was the first industrial capitalist society, and it was relatively so powerful with respect to the French, the Germans, the people in the United States, the Japanese, everybody. All those nations that became powerful were all little kids, let's say in the 1860s, compared with Britain. But by the time you got to the 1890s, only 30 years later, only another generation later, Britain was already being challenged, and because the hegemonic power, the unchallengeable power, could be challenged, not could be challenged, was being challenged, especially by the Germans, then very soon after that, or alongside it, by the U.S., and by the Japanese, by the 1890s, that meant that there was a crisis, a real crisis. And those of you who know anything about medicine at all will know that a crisis is a moment in a process when things have either got to get much better or they're going to get much worse. They can't stay where they are. It's either going to go to hell in a bucket or it's going to become something better. To get something better means that what brought you into the crisis has to be resolved, and it can only be resolved by being transformed, changed. So the crisis facing Britain, therefore facing the world because she was the hegemonic power, and if the boss is in trouble, everyone's in trouble, okay? We're the boss now, okay? And we're in trouble now. That's what I'm going to be saying in just a moment. If the boss is in trouble, then there's something wrong with the whole system over which the boss has been presiding. So what happened was that the kinds of circumstances, processes, relationships, and so on and so on, that had brought that crisis into being by the 1890s and obviously by 1900, because they were not resolved at all, and I might say could not have been resolved at all at that time, what you had was World War I, the most destructive war in all of history, in every way destructive, not just in terms of the number of people killed. The most destructive, that is to say, until World War II, which was, if we wanted to use a simple number, 10 times more destructive than the most destructive war in world history. So World War I exacerbated all the things that had caused World War I. Everything that had gone wrong was made harder to deal with because of the destruction of World War I, which was nothing compared to the destruction of World War II, which was nothing compared with the next war, kiddies, the next war, Nothing will survive after that one. So what you had was total, total revolution and counter-revolution and stasis and horror going on all over the world. Soviet Union came into being. It couldn't have come into being without World War I. Italian fascism within a couple of years. German fascism within a couple more years. Japanese fascism going alongside. All of these were fascists. French fascism coming into being but not being called that. And the worst depression of all in all history. The only country that came through that at all, the only major country that came through that at all with any kind of strength was the United States, including during the Depression. And when you look at what happened during the 1930s, the two countries that were hit hardest in terms of percentages of decline were the United States and Germany. But for Germany to go down by 50% in its gross national product, for Germany to have unemployment going to whatever it was, 25 or 30%, meant that chaos. Everything just went to... For the United States, we were so rich that we could go down by 50% and have official 25% unemployment. In fact, it was about 35% unemployment. Just as today's 5.2% unemployment, in fact, it's about 12% unemployment in the United States. The United States was so rich that when we went down, we still were not in a position of inability to function.
Doug, could you expand on the German situation during that period, year by year, when it was bad and when it started getting better and so forth?
It started getting bad the same time ours did, that is to say 29-30. And the pit was reached in 33 in both cases. And Hitler came into power in 33, with one-third of the vote only, incidentally. This is something you've got to understand. One-third of the vote. In any case, the United States was able to go through it because poverty is relative. I mean, a poor person in Germany in 1933 was much poorer, absolutely, than a poor person in the United States, as badly off as we may be, as we may have been. But I lived through the Depression. I was, in 1933, I was 14 years old. I started to work when I was 10 years old. And I don't remember ever, I mean, I had to work. My brother had to work. My mother had to work. I had no father. At least I didn't have one in the house. Fortunately, because if I'd had him around the house, we wouldn't be here, any of us, we wouldn't be in this room tonight. But the point I'm trying to make here is that although we never had the kinds of things that we would consider to be necessaries today, I don't remember ever feeling needy, even. You understand? I was working at 10 years old, and I never felt anything, really, any discomfort in my life. Whereas if I'd been in Germany, the same kind of situation, I really would have been like this, you know, gripped all the time. Anyhow, so the United States came out of this thing. And because all the other powers were weakened as much as they were, the United States was in a position because it was absolutely so strong and relatively so strong, even as 1940-41 approached, that when we went through the war, for one thing, we were harmed very, very little physically by it. In terms of the number of soldiers, the number killed were measured in the hundreds of thousands and less than 500,000. Whereas 60 million people died in Europe. 60 million, most of them civilians. There were perhaps 10 civilians who died in the United States because an army truck ran over them in the streets or something like that. So we came out of that war. They were economic, social, political crises that had led to World War I, not resolved. We came out of the Second World War, and it looked, some of you are old enough to remember what it looked like, felt like, in 1946, when the people were, 1945, standing in the streets and cheering, war is all over, and now we're going to have a different world. And it looked as though we could. And because we could, we would. But we didn't, because at the very time the war was ending, before it ended, the Cold War had begun. and the kind of leadership the United States might have had if it hadn't been the United States. If Henry Wallace, for example, had been sort of an average guy in the United States, the whole world would now be very different. All the crises could conceivably, could probably, would have been resolved. When Henry Wallace, who was vice president of the United States in two terms under Roosevelt, because the people knew, the people in the White House, the people in Congress knew that Roosevelt was going to die soon after his re-election in 1944. Soon. They saw to it that Henry Wallace, who was just a liberal guy, a decent liberal guy, they saw to it that he would no longer be vice president, so they stuck in this piece of shit, Harry Truman, who was one of the most corrupt people in the whole goddamn United States, who was owned lock, stock, and barrel by a political machine in Missouri, who was an arrogant brute, who became a hero to the people of the United States because he represents so much of what was wrong with the United States. He's very popular. He was anti-labor. He was a racist. He was a militarist. An all-American boy, in short. Well, who, I mean, he should be anti-Semite. You don't put the Jews, don't you? My mother was a Jew, just in case you're interested. So the Cold War began. 1943. Globalization began in 1943. IMF and the World Bank were created in 1943. And the plans began to unfold instead of us becoming a nation that would, in some sense or another, cause its own democracy and its own freedom to flower. What we did was to do everything we could to keep it from flowering anywhere else in the world, in the name of freedom, which we're still doing, of course. Every attempt that was made anywhere in the world, in the previously imperialized countries, to move toward really genuine freedom, genuine democracy, genuine independence from the richest countries in the world, we blocked. There are a couple of places where we began to seem to be working in favor of de-imperializing. In Indonesia, for example, we saw to it that the Dutch would be kicked out of Indonesia. And guess who went in? We saw to it that the British would be kicked out of the Middle East. And we went in. And we saw to it that the French would get out of wherever they might be. Except Indonesia. We tried to keep them there because we didn't want to go there. But once it was clear that they couldn't keep them, then we took over that too. But at the same time that we were doing this, we were also going through a period of McCarthyism that some of you went through and will remember, whose effects in the 1940s, early 50s, are well known. But people have paid very little attention to its long-term effects. I was part of that, too. I'm an old geezer. I was in the universities right after World War II, up to the end of the century, in the U.S. universities. And I can tell you the transformation of the kind of people who were professors, to what was being taught, what the curriculum was, the transformation between 1949 and 1999 was the transformation from what? From butter to grease. So that the students who became students, college students, let's say in the 50s and 60s and 70s, they were transformed. By the time you get into the 80s and the 90s, you couldn't get the kind of education, you just simply couldn't get it. It wasn't being given in the universities that you could have gotten in the 50s and the 60s. So the kind of people who were teaching and the kind of people who were taught from the 70s on, the kind of people who are now in Congress, the average person in Congress went to college in the 70s and the 80s, and the kind of information they got was a okay with McCarthy kind of an education, although we don't even know it anymore because we don't know what it could be. The kind of education I got at Berkeley in the late 40s and in the early 50s, and gave, beginning in 1949 myself, you can't get anywhere in the United States now, except at a couple of freaky places that nobody goes to. So what we had was a whole change of culture whole change of the whole way we treated ourselves at home and the way we treated people abroad. And in doing that, what we did was to create a new world. The same way the British created a new world in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s, we did in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And it was a world that obviously meant two kinds of things. One, it lifted for a significant percentage of the people in the world. It lifted the content and the level of the means of life. So that people, like myself, for example, who never would have dreamed of having decent health care in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, who never would have dreamed of having their kids go to college, who never would have dreamed of X, Y, Z, the whole kinds of things that's now more or less taken for granted. I'm not talking about TVs and kitchens, kitchenettes and so on. I'm talking about the kind of things that make life richer, make us... Not everybody. Now a significant percentage of the population takes that for granted. That's happened. There are now in the world, I would say, at least 1.5 billion people who are really living comfortably, who have more than they need. 200 years ago, there were only 1 billion people, and most of them were living badly. Now there are almost 6.5 billion people, and now there are over 4 billion people who are living worse than people ever lived in history. Because the people who were poor, by our standard, in 1800, were living better lives than the people who are poor today, and there are 4 times as many, or 5 times, or 10 times as many people who are poor today than there were 200 years ago. You take the average African, the average Latin American, the average Asian. They didn't have an automobile, they didn't have education, they didn't have health care, but what they had was a living. They were making a living on land. They were not rich. They were not even comfortable, but they had some kind of dignity. They had some kind of control, not complete, but some kind of control. They don't have anything like that at all anymore. I'll just give you one example. If you go into Bangkok, and I've been to Bangkok to see this years ago already. If you go into Bangkok, you go into practically any big city, any part of the poor part of the world. You want a whore who's 13 years old? There she is. Dozens of her. Now, where do they come from? That never happened 200 years ago. Now it's common. Now it's common to find 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 10-year-old girls who are sex slaves with their parents' acquiescence because things are so desperate. They've never been this bad for most of the people in the world. Now, we're the most powerful country in the world, and with power goes responsibility. We can't be blamed for everything, but we can be blamed for what hasn't happened that could have happened. And we can be blamed for what has happened that shouldn't have been allowed to happen. Not all of it. Only 80% of it. Now, what we've done with our globalization is we've made it possible for all kinds of things to happen. We've also done the same thing the British did. We have created a situation in which we're now at odds with each other. In 1890, the British, all of a sudden, found that they were being outdone by the Germans and the Americans, and soon after that, the Japanese. Now, who are we being outdone by? You read the newspapers? 10 years from now, China will be the USA, what the USA was in 1900, 1910. Coming around the corner, fast. Nobody can stop them. But it isn't just that. It isn't a question of China being a threat. That's not what I'm talking about. We've got a set of crises in the world now. They are economic crises. At their base, when you speak about a crisis in the capitalist era, and the capitalist era began a couple hundred years ago or so, more, but became really fulsome in the late 19th century. You think about a crisis in the capitalist era, you're talking about a crisis whose basis is economic. Because the basis of capitalism is economic. But it can never be only economic. If there's an economic crisis, there is also a political crisis, a cultural crisis, a military crisis. Always. Can't help it. The United States now it's useful to make comparisons. It's useful to say these things are similar, these things are different between Britain's hegemony and ours. Let me just go down a little kind of a list for you. Get down to brass tacks here. When Britain ran the world economy, 1860, or let's say, give them a break, 1910. But who was running whom by 1910 is another question. They were dealing with the world. When the British were running the world, they were dealing with a world which was much less permeable. It was harder to penetrate, much less interdependent. It was dealing with, in some sense or another, the childhood of today's globalization. When I say less permeable, I mean the traditions, the rest of the world. Every country in the whole world's history has been dominated by tradition, except us. We're the most traditionless society in world history. Because the people came here, we all know this expression, and they're supposed to get melted into the pot. And that meant melting away their traditions. But the kind of tradition, the kind of world that Britain lived in, that dominated, was a world that was dominated by traditions that were still very, very firm. That's for the poor people, too, whether Mexican, or one part of Africa, or one part of Asian, or another. It was still living within a framework of traditions. The imperialism, so to speak, of the 19th century was sort of like punches by the rich countries against the poor, in the poor countries. Globalization is like a tank rolling over, just crushing everything. So that the people have been rooted off the land. For one thing, the land, you've got to pay attention to this. For our species, work on the land has always been the heart of it. For almost all people, almost all the time, hard work, hard lives, but lives with a rhythm to them, with a stability to them. The stability we wouldn't want to live in. We couldn't, I couldn't, you couldn't. We couldn't live that way. But for them, that was the way you could live. That was the way you did live. Now you go to Mexico. Now you go anywhere in the world. And there's no way to live anymore except to live at the beck and call of the goddamn dollar. Or for most of the people, at the goddamn penny. The traditions have broken down. Everything is permeable now. Everything is penetratable. And everything is linked together. Something big happens there, tomorrow it's known there, somewhere else, and it's having its effect there. We are really linked together, for better and for worse, and it's mostly for worse, increasingly for worse. That wasn't true in British times. It was bad. It was awful. It was much worse than colonialism in British times. The difference between colonialism and imperialism was the difference of penetration, geographic, so to speak. The colonial era was a coastal era, you understand? Industrialism meant imperialism was penetrated geographically. Now the penetration is everything. You go to any place in the world now. Any place in the world. You're going to find people watching television. And they're going to be watching ads made in the USA, for products made in the USA. Now, most of those people can't buy it, but nevertheless, as General de Gaulle, hating the United States, said about 1947 or 8, if we let the Americans do this, they'll be Coca-Colonizing France. He was right. Making everybody American. There's this spread. It's like an oil spill of our culture all over the world. And there's a good book been written about it, which many of you have looked at least some of you have read, Jihad versus McWorld. Jihad versus McWorld. Now the guy who wrote that, I don't know him, but I know his works, is by my measure a conservative. You understand? His solution, I would piss on. But his analysis is on the right track. But listen carefully, Jihad versus McWorld, where Jihad is a kind of fanaticism in religion, which didn't invent itself. It came to be in a world in which any kind of sane thought was being threatened. Any kind of religious organization was being threatened. Versus McWorld. McWorld means the McDonaldization of the world. The commercialization of everything. And what Barber, that's his author's name, is worried about, is what happens to democracy in the meantime. Jihad doesn't care about it. McWorld doesn't care about it. McWorld cares about money. Jihad cares about faith, something more than faith. And there's very little space for anything else. In any case, that's true of our world now, and it's true because the technology that began to be developed and then became perfected from the 1940s on till now, we have this 24/7 kind of a world. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Never stops. The technology of communications, the technology of transportation, technology of production are all tightly linked. Make everything so powerful, so linked, so quick, so difficult to control. Some of you saw the film years ago, Grapes of Wrath, when the modernization of agriculture in the Southwest of Oklahoma, in this particular case, is taking place. Tom Jones gets out of prison, trying to go home to his family, and he hitchhikes, bumps into Muley. Muley's a white guy who was a neighbor. Bumps into Muley. Muley's sort of desperate, sort of crazy. And he starts telling Tom what's been happening there. They're tractoring us out. All the little houses, all the people are being knocked over by tractors, so they're making in modern agriculture. And Muley tells a little story where one day the tractor's coming, and the guy who's driving the tractor used to be his friend going to grammar school together. The guy driving the tractor is getting ready to knock over Muley's house, and Muley standing there with a gun, trying to shoot this guy in the tractor, which is like a tank, you know. And the guy in the tractor says, "Hey, man," he says, "don't shoot me. I'm just driving this tractor. Who am I going to shoot?" Tractor driver says, "Well, it's the bank this morning." He says, "I'll go and shoot the bank." He says, "No," he says, "the guy that tried, it's not them." He says, "The bank is in New York." So "I'll go shoot." And "Who am I going to shoot?" he says. "Who am I going to shoot?" That's where we are. Who am I going to shoot? Because there's a whole system going now. That wasn't true for Britain. That was kids playing back in Britain. Now, big boys are playing. And the whole world is as tight as it can be, but in many ways. One of the things that didn't happen for Britain is when its politics never really went beyond itself and its colonies. There was never a Cold War. The Cold War, because we all grew up in it, I didn't grow up in it, because most of us grew up in the Cold War, it was normal. It's the air we breathe. You sort of think, of course, of course. But there was a time when there wasn't that kind of, let's call it, ethic that was taken for granted as being necessary and essential, and which is today glorified. Oh, the Cold War was such a great success. You see this in university professors saying it was such a great success because, look, the wall went down. Ooh, all these kinds of wonderful things happened. The Cold War was a success. In the same sense that an earthquake is a success. And nothing to stop it. However, something else is different, something very, very different, economically speaking. And as I'll say once more, the political economy of capitalism is always the throbbing heart of it. When Britain was in charge, the year 1900, for example, which is pretty much its peak, it was the unquestionable dominating creditor nation of the world. You know what I'm going to say next, aren't you? Everyone owed Britain. Britain had a big trade deficit. Peanuts compared with the money coming in from all those who had borrowed from it, most especially Germany and the United States. And what did we do with our borrowing fund? We made ourselves stronger than Britain. The United States is not the greatest creditor in the world. We were when Reagan was elected. Now we are history's greatest debtor nation. There's never been anything like it ever, anytime, anywhere. We are debt. Our national debt breaks all records. Our household debt breaks all records. Our corporate debt breaks all records. Our foreign debt has never even been dreamed of. Our foreign debt is rising. Last year, and it's always rising, the rate is $662 billion we borrowed net last year. We now owe net, the last I saw, and these figures were for a year ago, $3 trillion we owe to the rest of the world. And we must continue to have that rate, that amount, go up at an ever-increasing rate, as we are doing at home and abroad. Why? Because the United States is the consumer of last resort. That's another way of saying the United States is the country to which all other countries are selling their absolutely necessary to sell exports. They have to lend to us so that we will buy from them. And as we buy from them, our economy gets always weaker in terms of production. We became a strong nation, as Britain became a strong nation, because of our production, because of our manufacturing. Manufacturing is way down as a percentage of what we do now. Services are way up. And within services, finance is way, way up. And you set aside the McDonald's and things like that, but cheap services. The financial world is now the dominating world. And the financial world itself is dominated by speculation, betting, gambling. That's what it's all about now. And that speculation is dominated by, guess what? Derivatives and hedge funds. I mean, we're talking about insanity, friends. We're talking about plain fucking insanity. Where this country, which is the center of power for the whole world, is a gambling casino run by a bunch of arrogant, ignorant, half-witted, fraternity boy jackasses. I'm thinking about the big financial houses, not just the Bush administration, but the big financial houses. Did you read today's paper about Mr. what's his name, Greenberg, or whatever it is, head of AIG, the largest insurance thing, the largest insurance what thing, the largest insurance combine in all of history, AIG. He is to the financial world what the name of that woman who just got out of jail? Martha Stewart. Yeah. Which then is complaining because they're making her wear this little thing on her foot so they know where she is. But he's the same kind of a thing, except he's got a four something trillion, was it 4 trillion, 4 billion, four something something, and so on and so on. He says, I didn't do nothing wrong. How could I do anything wrong? I'm Hank Greenberg. I know Hank Greenberg was a baseball player. I'm Greenberg, you know. I couldn't do anything wrong. He's really pissed off because they're trying to take him to court now for doing what is normal for big shots and so on. In any case, we are run, dominated by finance. Finance is dominated by speculation. And speculation is concerned with, what do you think? Debt. The speculation is in debt. The four largest creditors of the United States at the present time are, in order, Japan, China, coming up fast, South Korea, Taiwan. Did I say China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan? Where's Europe? If I were talking about this 10 years ago, it would have been Germany, France, Japan also. China, coming up fast. China has us by the short hair, you understand? China has its yuan, or its renminbi, tied to the dollar. And we say, don't do that. Why don't you do what little goy boys and girls do? I almost said goys and girls. Do what everyone else is doing. Let your currency fluctuate. Yeah. But the Chinese tie their currency to ours, which means that whatever happens, it's not going to hurt them. They can, anytime they want to, they can begin to sell their dollars, or they can let their currency fluctuate, or they can do what they're doing in today's paper. We've been talking about free trade, and they finally got free trade, some more degrees of free trade. What happens? The Chinese exports to the United States of textiles went up something like a third in just a couple of months. And now Bush is trying to do something, and so on. Now, the Chinese are not going to dump their dollars, and the Japanese are not going to dump their dollars, because they know if they do that, the whole thing will come tumbling down on everybody's heads. What they're trying to do, and my information comes from the central bank agency, which studies all the central banks in the world.